Conflict in the Middle East flows from generation to generation like a river of tears and bad blood, observed Mart Dehan. From the days of Abraham, in fact, when this conflict would have been sparked by the birth of Ishmael in the house of Abraham, the history we read of in Genesis 16 and Genesis 21, from that time we have an unending current of personal rejection and revenge and mutual loss that has been evident between Israel and many of its Arab neighbours. Some of the most bitter battles in this struggle have been fought on the soil of Lebanon. After the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, 110,000 Palestinians fled or emigrated from Israel to take refuge in Lebanon. Their numbers were swollen to more than 300,000 when the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, was evicted from Jordan after plotting to kill the King of Jordan in September of 1970. These Palestinian refugees and fighters who entered Lebanon repeated what they had been up to in Jordan. They created an unofficial state within a state in the southern part of Lebanon. They proceeded to use southern Lebanon as a base for their raids on northern Israel. In 1978, Israel invaded Lebanon in an attempt to root out those Palestinian militants. The United Nations sprang into action, passed United Nations resolutions 425 and 426, which called that Israel should immediately withdraw and end its military action in the country of Lebanon. At the end of their operations, the Israeli forces withdrew from Lebanon and left behind the United Nations peacekeeping force. 4 years later, however, in 1982, Israel invaded Lebanon again. This time it was in response to an assassination attempt upon Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom. That attempt had been launched by Fatah, the Revolutionary Council, and also at the time the PLO in southern Lebanon were launching artillery attacks against the towns in northern Israel. So Israel goes in again, 1982, and this time their forces push the PLO out of Lebanon, mostly into Tunisia, and Israel occupied the southern part of the country of Lebanon. In 1985, Israel withdrew its forces from parts of Lebanon, just remaining in a 4 to 6 kilometer deep strip of southern Lebanon that the Israelis called the security zone. They insisted it's necessary that we should stay here as a protective measure to defend our northern towns against the Katusha rockets. And that occupation, beginning in 1985, lasted until the year 2000. However, while they had the security zone, freedom from northern attacks was not set to last. In 1982, the Peace from Galilee War was no sooner over, fighting one terrorist organization, the PLO, and that being evicted into Tunisia, until another terrorist organization entered into southern Lebanon. It was a new grouping. They called themselves Hezbollah. Toward the end of 1982, Iran began to become quite involved in Lebanon. They sent fighters over from its Iranian Revolutionary Guards to help in the establishment of a revolutionary Islamic movement in the country of Lebanon. And this Hezbollah organization was established as a body for Muslim Shiite fundamentalists, led by religious clerics. Their members would be participating in what they called the Jihad, or the Holy War, against Israel. And unsurprisingly, the use of terror would be their principal means for attaining their political objectives. With Iranian and also Syrian backing, Hezbollah began to establish an extensive military network in the Baalbek area and the Beqa Valley in southern Lebanon. It set up storage depots for weapons, recruited activists and fighters. It provided widespread aid to some of the residents in southern Lebanon. They donated money, they gave over equipment, they provided medical supplies, and they were doing this social arm of the Hezbollah organization, they were doing it to build up support in the local population so that they would favor Hezbollah's military activities in the south of their country. Thousands of Hezbollah activists, members, have since spread into the Shiite Muslim neighborhoods in southern and western Beirut, as well as into all of southern Lebanon. They picked up activists and recruited fighters among the Muslim Shiite populations there. One of the first acts of the newly formed Hezbollah in 1983 was to launch a truck bomb attack against the Beirut barracks of peacekeeping forces in Lebanon. That attack cost the lives of 241 United States servicemen and 56 French servicemen who were all asleep in their respective barracks. The bloodshed coming from Hezbollah continued into the 1990s with multiple bombings in Argentina of Israeli and Jewish community facilities. They let off a bomb in March 1992 that killed 29 people, another in July 1994 that killed 96 people. Hezbollah is also credited with blowing a Panamanian jet out of the sky the same year, killing on that occasion 21 people. When the situation on its own border became unbearable, Israel launched various operations to push back the Hezbollah forces in southern Lebanon. Operation Accountability in 1983 was launched, followed in 1986 by Operation Grapes of Wrath. In mid-2000, Israel withdrew its troops from that little buffer area, the security zone, and a lot of people in Lebanon considered this as a real victory for the Hezbollah forces. It caused a huge boost in popularity to be given to this guerrilla group, the Hezbollah, in Lebanon, because they looked upon it as one of the very few Arab military groups that had succeeded in forcing Israel and its supporters to back down. But still, this withdrawal in mid-2000 was not enough for Hezbollah. They were looking for another excuse to keep on attacking Israel, and they latched on to a dispute over a 35 square kilometre parcel of area at the junction of the borders of Syria, Lebanon and Israel, the Sheba Farm. Now, those Sheba farms are claimed by both Syria and Lebanon, but they're controlled by Israel. Israeli maps, verified by the United Nations, show that the territory is part of Syria, and they lost it along with the Golan Heights back in the 1967 Six-Day War. So Hezbollah, with a new reason to attack Israel, renewed its assaults on the country over this contention that the area of the Sheba Farms belongs to Lebanon, and we're going to fight Israel for it. The incident that sparked the recent trouble that has dominated our news in the past number of weeks took place on the 12th of July 2006, when Hezbollah initiated an unprovoked rocket and mortar attack on Israel, firing at the troops, firing at the civilians in northern Israeli village of Shalomai, and that resulted in 5 civilian casualties. Then a large ground contingent of Hezbollah militants attacked 2 Israeli armoured Humvee vehicles who were on a routine patrol on the Israeli side of the border. They attacked them with anti-tank rockets. They killed 3 soldiers. They kidnapped 2 others. And rather ironically and sadly, those 2 that they kidnapped were both reservists on their last day of operational duty. An Israeli tank was destroyed as the day went on, 4 Israeli soldiers killed. Then later on, when the Israeli forces, the IDF soldiers, went out and tried to reclaim their soldiers, they got into a fierce firefight on the Lebanese territory, and another Israeli soldier was killed. So by then, 8 Israeli soldiers had been killed, 2 captured, 6 wounded. It was one of the highest one-day death tolls for the Israeli military in more than 4 years. On Wednesday, the 13th of July, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said that Israel held Lebanon responsible for the Hezbollah raid, and he promised a painful and far-reaching response. The murderous attack this morning was not a terrorist act, it was an act of war. So in an operation that was reminiscent of the previous invasions back in 1993, 1996, Israel launched Operation Just Reward, later renamed Operation Change of Direction. Now this retaliatory strike has so far included bombing raids by the Israeli Air Force. There's been an air and Israeli Sea Corps naval blockade of Lebanon, especially around southern Lebanon and Beirut itself. There's been a limited ground offensive which continues into southern Lebanon by the Israeli troops. Israel's Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Dan Halut, said, "We will fight terror, whatever it is, because if we do not fight it, it will fight us. If we don't reach it, it will reach us." Now there are parallels between what is happening in the conflict in southern Lebanon today and northern Israel and the battle in which we as the people of God are engaged. And there is no doubt that as God's people, the words of this Israeli Army Chief of Staff are very relevant to us. If we do not fight it, well, it will surely fight us. And if we don't reach it, if we are not proactive in going out against it, well, it's going to come looking for us, and it will reach us. The first parallel centers on what I'm terming eradication. Hezbollah has consistently demanded the destruction of Israel. In its worldview, first published in February 1985, Hezbollah insists the only solution to the problems in Lebanon is the establishment of Lebanon as an Islamic Republic. They also claim that Western imperialization must be fought and eradicated from Lebanon. That means all of the American forces, all of the French, must withdraw from Lebanon along with all of their institutions. The conflict with Israel is viewed as a central concern. Now that conflict isn't just limited to the Israeli Defense Forces' presence in and around Lebanon, but rather the express goals of Hezbollah are the complete destruction of the state of Israel. It decries that state as being the little Satan. It views it as foreign to the region, a threat to Islam and to the Muslims who are round about, and it wants the establishment of Islamic rule over the city of Jerusalem. In an effort to realize its goals, Hezbollah leaders actively plan and perpetuate terror attacks against the IDF forces. They preach up religious extremism against Israel. They cause to be disseminated Iranian ideology. And I'll mention more of that in a moment. Sheikh Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, said in January 2000, "When we speak about Jerusalem, we don't want anyone to misunderstand. We do not mean East Jerusalem, we do not mean the Holy Jerusalem, we do not mean Jerusalem, the city. When we say Jerusalem, we speak of it as a symbol of all Palestine and the entire nation that is under assault by the scheme of global arrogance and Zionism that throughout the past 50 years has been implemented on our land. Israel," he says, "is a cancerous, usurping entity without legitimacy or legal character. It should not exist." That's the view of the leader of Hezbollah. On the 2nd of June 2000, in a speech that was broadcast via telephone to the Palestinian rally at Gaza, Nasrallah again called on the Palestinians to fight the Zionists with stones, daggers, knives and bombs, expel them from the land and make them return to whence they came. He urged Palestinians to undertake suicide bombings, such as the one that had been perpetuated at Beit Lid in Israel, where 22 young Israelis were murdered. In that particularly savage attack, bombs exploded at timed intervals in order to kill those who were rushing in to help the initial victims. Little wonder then that when Ted Koppel of ABC News interviewed that Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah on October the 20th, 2000, he said, "If I were an Israeli leader listening to you right now, I would say, Nasrallah, you're asking me to talk about negotiating my own surrender, my own suicide. Why should I even continue talking with you or anybody else representing the Palestinians if ultimately all you want to do is to destroy me?" In October 2002, this Hezbollah leader Nasrallah asserted that if the Jews all gathered in Israel, it will save us the trouble of going after them worldwide. Now, this is so typical of Arab rhetoric against Israel. They preach it through their speeches. Nasrallah's position finds an echo in the opinion of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the spiritual leader of Iran. The Ayatollah described Israel as an infectious tumor for the entire Islamic world. Syria, the other nation, as well as Iran, that is heavily promoting Hezbollah, is no better. The official radio station of the Syrian government, Damascus Syrian Arab Republic Radio in Arabic, carried a live sermon from one of its mosques in Damascus on the 27th of February 2004. Dr. Abdallah Rabil delivered the sermon and he prayed, "O God, deal with the criminal Zionists and those with them and behind them, for they are within your power. O God, scatter them, disperse their assemblies, lower their flags, destroy their economy, and make the cycles of evil turn around against them. O God, show us the miracle of your power on them. O God, make them destroy themselves. O God, bring down your anger on them." So those are typical speeches from these Arab nations that are set against the people of Israel. Not only do they preach it in their speeches, they teach it in their schools. Of all the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia is perceived to be a friend of America. And much is made of their relationship one with the other. And yet lessons in the Saudi Arabian textbooks that are exported in large quantities to Muslims in other countries, they depict Christians as swine and Jews as apes. One of the lines out of those school textbooks is this: "The apes are Jews, the people of the Sabbath, while the swine are the Christians, the infidels of the communion of Jesus." Another line: "Allah's apostle said, the hour will not be established until you fight with the Jews. And the stone behind which a Jew will be hiding will say, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, so kill him." But the position of this trio of dark forces that we'll concentrate upon tonight, Hezbollah, supported and assisted by Iran and by Syria, their position is plain. They want nothing less than the total elimination of Israel and the eradication of all Israelis. And that's the purpose behind those Hezbollah rockets that have been raining down upon Israel over the past number of weeks. At this moment, missiles are the mainstay in the Hezbollah offensive against Israel. More than 2,000 rockets and missiles have been fired into Israeli towns and cities and agricultural villages since the current round of fighting erupted. Apparently, the boast is there are many more where these have come from. The Hezbollah leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, has repeatedly said that his group has more than 12,000 of these rockets, most of them Katyushas. But the missile issue isn't just one of mere numbers. If they have 12 or 13,000 or even more than that, experts agree that these Katusha rockets that they have a lot of, they're inaccurate. They're pretty short range. They do make up the bulk of Hezbollah's arsenal. They have a range of about 12 miles. They say that they don't pose a serious military threat to Israel. They are a terrible threat to the civilian population, of course. They're a very effective terror weapon, forcing the Israeli residents in the northern towns in Israel to sleep in bomb shelters, sometimes for days on end, for fear of these attacks. Because of the rockets, the Israeli Defense Minister Peretz told commanders to prepare civil defense plans, and some 220,000 Israeli civilians were sent to the bomb shelters. However, in addition to these Katusha rockets, Hezbollah has been supplied with up to 120 Fair 3 and Fair 5 rockets that have larger range, 22 miles, 45 miles, respectively. And so for the first time, those Hezbollah attacks have gone over those villages and towns on the border or close to the border and gone as far down as Haifa, 30 miles from the Lebanese border, Israel's third largest city. They've hit into the Jezreel Valley. They've hit the city of Nazareth. They've hit Afula. It was a Fair 3 rocket that hit Haifa on Sunday, 16th of July, that killed 8 people. Robert Lowe, manager of the Middle East program at London think tank Chatham House, said there may be a missile in Hezbollah's possession capable of reaching Tel Aviv. Now, the very thought that a missile could be launched from Lebanon and get right down to Tel Aviv, about 100 miles south of the Lebanese border, puts fear into the heart of every Israeli. That city, Tel Aviv, is the hub of their country. Its metropolitan area, around about 1 million people would live in it, and an attack there would be a major escalation of the Hezbollah assaults. But experts do say that Hezbollah, which is already a pretty formidable fighting force, is becoming ever more sophisticated. It has added to its arsenal of rockets, innovative technology such as night vision. It has flown remote-controlled drones, unmanned aerial vehicles over northern Israel, at least twice since 2004. And the question is asked, who is supplying Hezbollah with this kind of weaponry? The answer is Iran. This relationship with Iran, said Anthony Kordsman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, this relationship with Iran has been going on for more than a decade and has led to the exchange of steadily more sophisticated technologies. According to intelligence sources, a major weapons consignment destined for the Hezbollah movement arrived at Damascus Airport in Syria from Iran in the month of March of this year. This Iranian consignment was transported in a military convoy through Syria along Lebanon's Baqa Valley to the Hezbollah bases down in the south of Lebanon. That convoy had received an official transit permit from the Lebanese government, which knew not only the precise nature of the shipment, but also where it was going. Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, said this kidnapping on the 12th of July of the Israeli soldiers, "We're aiming at negotiations here to try and force the hand of the Israelis that they will release three of our Lebanese prisoners that are held in Israeli jails. We'll do a swap." "Let this be clear," he said. "The prisoners will only return home through indirect negotiations and trade. If the Israelis are considering any military action to bring the hostages home, they are delusional. Delusional, delusional. But we would be suffering from a triple delusion. If we were to believe tonight that the only reason behind this recent attack, this incursion into Israel, was for the return of a couple of prisoners, there is no doubt that back of it all, both Iran and Syria have vested interests or agendas running through this current conflict. Let's think of the Syrian agenda. What are they looking out of it? Well, Syria has a clear agenda in the conflict. It is using Hezbollah to strike Israel, of course, so that it can come in again. It's only left Lebanon over a year, so that Syria can come in again and reassert its authority over all of Lebanon and maintain some leverage through this Hezbollah attack against Israel in Syria's bid to reclaim the Golan Heights and the Sheba Farms territories. United States President George W. Bush said on July the 20th, Syria was using the turmoil in an effort to get back into Lebanon. As I've just said, it was only just over a year since Damascus, Syria, ended what was effectively a long-term military occupation by them in the land of Lebanon. And Bush said of Syria that it's using this incident here to reassert its influence in Beirut. We have worked hard to free, and we being the international community, worked hard to free Lebanon from Syrian influence. It's in our interest for Syria to stay out of Lebanon and for this government, the Lebanese government, to survive. When the Syrians were in control of Lebanon, Syria allowed Hezbollah to be the only major military force not to be disarmed in that Lebanese area. Syria calculated, you see, if we allow this guerrilla war prosecuted by Hezbollah to keep on going, it will bleed Israel until it'll tire of trying to control Hezbollah's attacks, and Israel will eventually agree to return the Golan Heights to us in exchange for a bit of peace on its northern border. So that's why Syria is involved in supporting and backing Hezbollah. Of more concern is the Iranian agenda for the region. If you've been following the news, and I'm sure you have over the past year or so, there's great consternation in the West in particular because of the development of nuclear armaments. Of course, Iran says, oh no, it's only for peaceful purposes that we are trying to get this nuclear fuel. But anyone with any idea about what's happening knows full well they're trying to become a nuclear military power in Iran. And it's interesting to ask, not why Hezbollah launched an attack on a routine Israeli military platoon along the Lebanese border on the 12th of July, but why it chose that specific time. One thing is sure, the attack was neither random nor impulsive. It appears to have been carefully calculated and intricately planned. Certainly Hezbollah would not have mounted this kind of operation without the prior knowledge and approval of its two leading patrons, Iran, which arms, trains, funds Lebanon Shiite fanatics, and Syria, which serves as a nice little route, a conduit, and provides essential logistical support. In fact, the operation on the border that day, 12th of July, had probably been on the drawing board for many months. As far as Iran is concerned, the Hezbollah attack is not just launched to make life difficult for Israel and embarrass them, but to deflect worldwide attention from Iran's nuclear weapons program. The transfer of rockets that we mentioned from Iran to Hezbollah in March of 2006 came just 1 month after Iran had ended its voluntary cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and they could have come along and unannounced inspected Iran's nuclear facilities. And at the same time, as this missile consignment is heading from Iran up into Syria and down through into Lebanon to be delivered to the Hezbollah, at the same time as this missile consignment is on its way, a senior Iranian official said that his country would inflict harm and pain on the United States and its allies. It vowed to use any means to resist any pressure and threats designed to curb Iran's nuclear program. A month later, the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he had called for Israel to be wiped off the map. He made the announcement that Iranian scientists had completed the nuclear fuel cycle. They were enriching uranium. That's the essential ingredient for a nuclear weapons program. So why did Hezbollah wait until the other Wednesday to unwrap their missiles? Well, lost in the heat and the dust of the attack and the counterattack was a brief statement issued in Paris on the same day by the French foreign minister on behalf of foreign ministers from the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, Germany, the European Union. Since Iran had not responded to a five-week-old demand now to resume negotiations with the International Atomic Energy Association over suspending its nuclear program, the French foreign minister said, "We have no choice but to return to the United Nations Security Council and take forward the process suspended 2 months ago." Now that announcement that Iran would have been waiting for is the likeliest trigger for that incursion into Israel. And the message that Tehran in Iran was giving back, courtesy of its Lebanese sidekick, the Hezbollah, was loud and clear: "We can strike you, and we will strike you, if you put more pressure on us about our nuclear program. We'll take it on in other parts of the Middle East." In a report to the United States Congress in January 2006, by the new American intelligence supremo, John Negroponte, he said that Iran was perfectly capable of sparking a wide conflict if Iran felt threatened. Hezbollah, he added, is Iran's main terrorist ally. It is a worldwide support network. It is capable of attacks against U.S. interests if it feels its Iranian patron is threatened. And as far as Iran is concerned, because Iran has a big picture in mind here, which is why it's developing and so keen to develop the nuclear armaments, as far as it is concerned, this little battle in Lebanon, it is furthering Iran's aims for the dominion of the Middle East and ultimately for the global triumph of Islam. On Tuesday, 18th of July, 2006, the Iranian president praised the Hezbollah attacks and he claimed, "The day of happiness for the region is near. The world is on the verge of great changes." He said to Israel, "You're playing with fire." Douglas Davis, writing in an article for The Spectator entitled "Iran Has Declared War on the Rest of the World," he said that because of the current struggle, we all know now, if we didn't before, that Ahmadinejad meant exactly what he said. That's the Iranian president. When he pronounced his desire to wipe Israel off the map, he is perfectly willing to have a democratic, reviving Lebanon sacrificed merely as an opening skirmish. We're not really talking here about, "We have two of your soldiers, you have three of ours, we want an exchange." We're not talking as well about just bombing establishments in Lebanon or hurling over rockets, thousands of them, into Israel. Much is riding on the outcome of the current conflict, not just for Israel, not just for Lebanon, not just for the Hezbollah, but also for the rest of the world. It will affect a whole slew of states in Africa, in Asia, Europe, The Middle East itself will all be affected by this. This battle in Lebanon is part of a much wider Shia Islamic conspiracy. Former Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff General Moshe Ya'alon points up this broader Hezbollah agenda. Hezbollah ideology, he says, is not just about Lebanon or about Israel. Hezbollah ideology is Iranian revolutionary Shia extremist ideology, which means to impose Islam everywhere possible. Another commentator, David Shelbourne, under the headline, "The Islamists Are Winning," sees the fighting in Lebanon again through a wide-angle lens. He said, despite the heat and the harm doing of the present local warfare, the battle frontier is merely one front, and a minor front at that, in the wider conflict between the Islamic and the non-Muslim worlds. A war now being fought with differing degrees of intensity and in different ways, from Afghanistan to the Horn of Africa, from the Caucasus to Kashmir, from Nigeria to Xinjiang, and from the Levant, this region around Lebanon, to Southeast Asia. Above all, he says, the weapons aimed at Israel are not merely the Katusha, the Rad 2 and 3, the Iranian Fyar, and the Zelzad. Rather, they are the weapons of the Ummah, the community of resurgent Islam, the church militant of the 21st century, weapons which are now deployed across the globe. Or, as Hezbollah's leader put it last weekend, Hezbollah is not fighting a battle for Hezbollah, or even for Lebanon, and certainly not for those Sheba farms. We are now fighting a battle for the Islamic nation. Now, Islam's full of empty rhetoric. But even allowing for Muslim rhetoric, with all of its language of blood and fire and smoke, Nasrallah's warning should be taken seriously. The confidence that he is the leader of Hezbollah shows, the confidence of these other fire-breathing clerics, makes clear that the advance of this Islamic nation has got the Muslim world watching in with great interest, and all of the non-Muslim world, above all the United States, it has got them in growing trouble. America's leaders themselves, I'm sure you've noticed, are quite unable to decide who and what they're fighting. In Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in other places? Is it Islam? Is it Islamic radicalism? Is it terror? And while they strike out at either or all of these enemies in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, etc., they have yet to realize in the American leadership the fact that many of these terrorist organizations are being funded directly from contributions raised among Muslim populations in the United States of America. All sorts of rackets and scams are pushed there. There was a big fund raising operation traced to around Detroit, where the Shia Muslims are concentrated. Round about 500,000 of them there. And the money was going through Detroit right out to the funding of Hezbollah and other Islamic terrorist organizations. Extermination of Israel is the name of the game for Hezbollah, Iran, and Syria. And Israel, quite understandably, is determined to resist this cross-border missile threat to its towns and its cities and its people by applying a blunt lesson in deterrence. It is vowed to finish the job this time on Hezbollah. It's bombarding its infrastructure before it wants to here establish a buffer zone again and put in the buffer zone between Lebanon and Israel an international UN force. The Israeli cabinet has authorized severe and harsh retaliation on Lebanon after the kidnapping and killing of its soldiers. Israel's chief of staff told Israel's Channel 10, if the soldiers are not returned, we will turn Lebanon's clock back 20 years. But if they were really to go for Hezbollah, they'd have to move into the strategically important Bekaa Valley, a step that will send off the alarm bells ringing at full noise in Syria and spreading out into an even wider confrontation. Now, to set this present unrest against a biblical background, there is no doubt that God chose Israel out of all the peoples of the earth to have a special place in history of redemption through Jesus the Messiah. Deuteronomy 7 and 6 says, "For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth." He promised the land of Canaan to Abraham and to his seed. You can check it out in Genesis 13 and 15. Genesis 26, 3 to 4, Genesis 35, 10 to 12, where that promise is renewed to Isaac and then to Jacob and then to Moses in Deuteronomy 34 and the verse 4. And the boundaries of that land that God was promising were clearly drawn. It was, Genesis 15, 18, from the river of Egypt unto the river Euphrates. But God also, in choosing them, giving them a land, assured them of penalties. Should they disobey him, they would be punished, he said, by being scattered throughout the world. Deuteronomy 28:15, verses 63 and 64 as well, the same chapter. Matthew 21, the verse 43. And God also said, though they would be scattered through their disobedience, there would be a return to the land that he had appointed for them. And he said that away back in the days of Moses, Deuteronomy 30, verses 3 to 5. Now, when Israel was scattered, during the days of her exile, lasted a long time, the most notable occupants of Palestine during Israel's exile were the Arabs who came in there from surrounding nations, and having lived in Palestine for several hundred years, the Arabs now, unsurprisingly, claim a right to the land. Now, the New Testament repeats the promise that God has a future for Israel. Romans 11 verses 25 to 27 among many other references. And many people see the return of the Jews to their land beginning in 1948 as a fulfillment of the prophecies we read in Ezekiel 20, 33 to 35 and Ezekiel 36, 16 to the verse 24. The major problem is, however, that most Jews returned to their land, 1948 and beyond, not in thankfulness and praise unto Jehovah and to the Messiah Jesus. But they returned to their ancient land in unbelief. Most of the Jewish people are still at enmity with God. They reject Jesus as their Messiah. Romans 11 and the verse 28. Now this signals to me that I must act with caution in endorsing everything modern Israel does. Keeping in mind the promises God has made to this nation, I have a sympathy for her in her plight. I agree with her right and every other country's right to repel terrorist attacks, and I often admire her stoical determination in this. However, I must be cautious and try as best I can to distinguish between what God is doing in Israel and what Israel herself is doing with or without the approval of God. I know that human error always intermingles with the promises and purposes of God. We often, even in our country and in our lives, we try to be wiser than God and run ahead of God as a result. In fact, the early history of the nation of Israel is a supreme object lesson of this. For way back then, age of 85, Abraham, the father of a great nation, he was still without a child and therefore without an heir, so there was going to be no nation. Now, believing that his wife Sarah could no longer have a child of her own, the couple decides it's time for us to act outside of God and solve our own problem. Genesis 16, the verse 3. Within a year, Ishmael is born to Hagar, Sarah's maid. Now we have a situation in Abraham's house where there are two wives and two sons competing for Abraham's affection. The house is not big enough for all of them. Abraham asks Hagar and Ishmael, her son, to leave, and though they went out into the wilderness and they're about to die, let's note it, heaven responded tenderly to their tears. Genesis 21, verses 17 to 20. The angel of the Lord preserved them out there, and a rather troubling prophecy was made concerning Ishmael, Genesis 16 and 12, and he will be a wild man, literally a wild donkey. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. What is happening in the Middle East today is Abraham's estranged children, the descendants of Isaac on the one hand, the descendants of Ishmael on the other hand, his estranged children are now fighting over his legacy. And the bitterness of this fight proclaims to me that one of the chief lessons we can derive from this conflict, both then and now, is how much we need Christ, the Prince of Peace. Now, in terms of a spiritual application, our enemy, like Israel's, is intent on our total destruction. 1 Peter 5, 8 and 9, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, goes about trying to rattle people's cages, trying to wind people up the wrong way. No, seek him whom he may devour. Whom resist steadfast in the faith? For still our ancient foe doth seek to work his woe. His craft and power are great, and armed with cruel hate. There are no half measures with the devil or with the world. No sooner does he back off, or appear to be backing off, than the offensive is renewed with terrible ferocity again. So we thought of eradication. That's the main point. Couple of add-on points. One is evaluation. How do we look upon this war? Well, any assessment of it must include a physical evaluation, casualties, in other words. Figures that are cited may not be that accurate, but to date the hostilities have cost 392 Lebanese lives, 41 Israeli deaths. It's claimed that very few fighters in the Hezbollah movement have been killed, that most of the Lebanese who have died have been ordinary civilians. Dan Lutz, former Israel Air Force commander, claimed that close to 100 Hezbollah fighters have been killed, but Hezbollah themselves say, oh no, not at all, only a small number of casualties have we sustained so far, but the exact number remains unclear. Understandably, publicity has centered on the civilian deaths. Israel has been accused of intentionally targeting civilian infrastructure and causing numerous civilian deaths. In its defense, Israel has stated that Hezbollah has a huge arsenal, has fired 1,000 missiles at us, update that to 2,000. Keep updating it as time goes on. We are acting in self-defense, they say. We are targeting only military objectives, including transport facilities that Hezbollah can use. But you have to remember that Hezbollah often hides in civilian areas. We sent flyers. We gave other warnings to civilians to leave before our attacks. And if you say, well, they've been bombing bridges, they will say, yes, we have. Because we don't want further weaponry and missiles coming in from back there in Lebanon and being brought up to the front within launching range of us. But it would appear that no area seems safe. Although television reports have suggested on occasions that vast parts of Lebanon are not being hit by Israeli warplanes, and I saw footage last night of Beirut and people living just as though nothing were happening, and it only happening maybe 1 kilometer away, but life for them was going on, very much going on. One fact that doesn't seem to receive as much media attention, and we are used to this with the conflict in Northern Ireland, one fact that doesn't seem to be spotlighted as much is that Hezbollah has indiscriminately fired more than 2,000 artillery rockets at civilian areas in Israel throughout the conflict. And the rockets have gone up and landed in all the major cities of Northern Israel, Haifa, Nazareth, Tiberias, Naharaim, Safed. Approximately 750,000 people, or 12% of Israel's population, live in those areas that currently are being targeted by this guerrilla group. No one knows where the next rocket will land. Now, in addition to deaths, during the fighting, 500,000 civilians, 500,000 have been displaced in southern Lebanon, at least 220,000 in northern Israel. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has said that Lebanon faces a massive humanitarian task. It needs urgent funding, it needs a ceasefire, and in the absence of one, it's imperative that we open safe aid corridors in Lebanon. And the Israeli forces have and expanded those corridors between Lebanon and Cyprus. Now, if we were to draw an obvious, natural conclusion, we'd have to say war, in all of its manifestations, is extremely nasty, very cruel, and a spiritual application, the devil never spares anything, not even the innocents in pursuit of his objective. Remember what he did in Egypt? Took out all the Israeli male children at a time. He did it in Bethlehem to get at Jesus. When we think of the political evaluation of the conflict, it appears there's hardly a country in the world that doesn't have something to say and doesn't therefore have a vested interest in the events that are unfolding in this region. We should begin with Lebanon itself. After almost 30 years of bitter struggle, pretty much like ourselves, but a lot more devastation, of course, when you look at the pictures back then and they're warm. After 30 years of that struggle being contested on its soil, the Lebanese must have the depressing feeling that once again they are being asked to pay the price for unfinished business between Syria and Israel. They must feel that everybody here has their own agenda, and they're but an abused pawn on the chessboard. A student at Christian St. Joseph University in Beirut, who was active in the anti-Syrian demonstrations back in April, put forward this view. He said, when foreign powers want to wage war, they do it in our country. We've been at war for 25 years, although Lebanon has no weapons industry. We pay for all the Arabs. Almost immediately after the hostilities began, Lebanon's Prime Minister, Fuad Sinoura, called for a ceasefire. On the 14th of July, he'd been talking to President Bush, and he issued a statement that he is calling on President Bush to exert all his efforts on Israel to stop its aggression on Lebanon, reach a comprehensive ceasefire, and lift its blockade. But Condoleezza Rice, speaking from St. Petersburg on the 16th of July, seemed to say, oh, we're not calling for an immediate ceasefire, because the ceasefire demanded by Lebanon's president would be unworkable unless it first addresses Hezbollah violence and the support that Hezbollah is getting from Syria and from Iran. She said the only way to deal with it is to deal with the extremists, isolate the extremists, and put in place modern democratic states. Now, the United Nations has been calling on Lebanon to deal with Hezbollah for decades. Look out, the terrorists! Man your own borders, take over your land, from them. The Lebanese government, before this all started up again, was under international pressure to put its troops into the south of its country and rein in those Hezbollah terrorists. But most people say, well, that's pie in the sky. Lebanon can't do it. Doesn't have the resources. It would deeply fracture the country. It would rip it apart. We dare not try that kind of move. It was interesting that on Thursday, 14th of July, Lebanese Prime Minister made a strong statement yet against this Shiite militant group, the Hezbollah. In an Italian newspaper, he said that Hezbollah had done what the PLO used to do in their country, created a state within a state, adding, the entire world must help us disarm Hezbollah, but first we need to reach a ceasefire. But then he issued another statement denying that first statement. And in a dramatic reverse, he said that rather he told the paper that the international community must help press Israel from the Chibaf arms. The continued presence of Israeli occupation of Lebanese lands in the Chibaf arms region is what contributes to the presence of Hezbollah weapons. The international community must help us in getting an Israeli withdrawal from Chibaf arms so that we can solve the problem of Hezbollah's arms. Now, where have we heard things like that before? In Lebanon today, there's anger at Hezbollah for provoking Israel into attacking Lebanon. And some have expressed the view that Hezbollah should be pursued by Israel to destruction. Israel, great anger against them because they're saying you're punishing a country that has hardly any control over this Hezbollah movement. And the international community, they're saying you're dragging your heels. You should be coming faster to help us end the conflict. There's been a mixed response from the Arab nations. The Sunni Muslim nations are frightened that the Shia Muslim nations are just becoming too aggressive and gaining too much power. And so on the one hand, Iran, Syria, Yemen are supporting Lebanon, Hezbollah. On the other hand, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia are criticizing Hezbollah for harming Arab interests. They're blaming them for starting the conflict, and they simultaneously criticize Israel for what they're saying is an over-escalated response. Russia likes to get its oar in. It has sharply criticized Israel for what it's done in Lebanon. The Russian Foreign Ministry, Sergei Lavrov, said that Israel's actions have gone far beyond the boundaries of an anti-terrorist operation, and he called for an immediate ceasefire. Well, I wonder, just as a point of interest, was Russia so keen on an immediate ceasefire when they were pursuing the Chechen rebels? Over the past couple of years, Russia has quietly moved from a position of cooperation with the United States to one of rivalry. President Putin, the former KGB officer, is staking a claim to superpower status for his country. It's bolstered today by billions of dollars in oil and gas revenues, and he wants to take up an independent position on a variety of international issues, including those issues in the Middle East. Why is he doing it? Because he has a fierce desire for global power status and recognition. Then we have America. Washington is sympathetic to calls to provide humanitarian aid to the people of Lebanon, but it's rejecting calls for an immediate ceasefire, saying that's only a simplistic solution to the problem and should only be agreed after certain conditions are met. George Bush said the root of the problem is Hezbollah. He said the US is never going to tell a nation how to defend herself. He's been backed up by his House of Representatives in a vote 410-8. And as for the main protagonist, Hezbollah, Israel, Hezbollah has been talking about the exchange of prisoners. But if Hezbollah limps out of this whole process with even a shred of military credibility from taking on mighty Israel, when the Security Council calls time, pulls down the shutters and says, right, guys, it's over, stop the fighting. If they limp away with some credibility, the outcome will be viewed as a huge victory for Islam. And that triumph, because that's how it will be packaged, would be likely to carry the seeds of accelerated radicalism. possibly devastating consequences, not only for the West, but for those clutch of Middle East states that already are facing an increasing Muslim threat: Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and of course Lebanon itself. Israel said, "We'll have a ceasefire if you return our soldiers. If you stop firing rockets at our country. If you and Lebanon implement the UN Security Council Resolution 1559, which calls for the Hezbollah's disarmament. Do that, and we'll stop. Will a compromise position be reached?" Israel has compromised, signed peace accords, given ground in the past, but always discovered its enemy is treacherous and relentless. When the first Israeli PLO agreement was signed in September 1993, the famous Oslo Accords, Israeli leaders promised there'll be a drop in terrorist activity. We've signed this so that our people will not be killed. But the reverse occurred. More Israelis were killed in terrorist attacks after the accords than before. In fact, in the 30 months after that date, more Israelis were killed by terrorists, 213 in total, than in the previous 10 years. 209 from January 1983 to September 1993. Overall, in the 2 years that followed that 1993 deal, as compared to the 2 years that preceded it, Israel suffered 73% more terror fatalities. The compromise, it didn't work. Hillel Kashan, a professor of political science at the American University of Beirut, said that he thinks it will pan out this way. A ceasefire agreement will be reached sometime next week, he said, in which Hezbollah will disarm and stop attacks on Israel. In exchange, Israel will leave an area that those two countries have a common border at, that Sheba Farms area that Hezbollah is claiming belongs to Lebanon. The two sides, he says, will swap prisoners, including those two Israeli soldiers that were kidnapped on the 12th of July. Hezbollah's days are numbered, Kashan said in a phone interview. Eventually, it will be a political party without a military wing. Is there deja vu coming in there regarding Northern Ireland politics? Eventually it'll become a political party without a military wing. By losing the Sheba Farms, it loses its justification of existence as an armed group. Now, as far as the Christian struggle with the world and the devil is concerned, in spite of what all the contrary voices, in spite of all the opinions that people bring us, past compromises would teach us that no peace is possible with the devil and with the world. That no negotiation is profitable with the devil and with the world, Romans 12:1 and 2. Ephesians 4 verse 27 is really good advice. Neither give place to the devil. We have a responsibility to denounce our enemy, not allow him to operate on our territory, shake off all his sympathizers, and take a stand against all evil. Eradication. Evaluation. We'll finish with evacuation. And I hope that doesn't prompt when I say that an evacuation here. The conflict in Lebanon has prompted a mass escape from the war zone. Some have gone over the top and said it's a second Dunkirk. As Israel went on the offensive, it dropped leaflets, it broadcasted warnings to the population of southern Lebanon, vacate villages and towns, and that sent panicked residents screaming towards the coastal city of Tyre. Ally Hejazi said, "We left immediately when we heard the warning, not stopping to pack or even bring money." Doesn't that sound terribly like Matthew chapter 24? "He that's on the housetop, don't go down into the house to take the stuff. Get out while you can." What we see today is a precursor, a forerunner of what will happen at the ending of time. And he said he took the route along created routes to the seafront rest house, hotel and tavern that has become a centre for refugees. Nicholas Blandford, writing for the Australian from Tyrone on the 20th of July 2006, titled his article, Exodus, Thousands Flee as Blitz Destroys Homes. On Thursday, 14th of July, about 40 US Marines arrived at a beach that was just north of Beirut in a landing craft and picked up 300 Americans, and he ferried them over onto an amphibious assault ship, USS Nashville, that was just off the coast, and then from there on to Cyprus, and many others were taken out this way. One US family said as they were leaving Beirut, "We're sad, because I will leave all of these wonderful Lebanese people behind in sorrow and heartache." 22nd of July, Saturday passed, was the deadline for British passport holders to escape the country. People were told, you have to register if you want evacuated before 4 p.m. or else stay and sit out the war. The last British evacuees, all 700 of those in the last train, basically, out of the country, the last boat, left and board a ship for Cyprus. For some, it was a very agonizing decision. Families were split because of those who had British citizenship and passports and those who did not. And as he said, their emotional goodbyes, they didn't know when, if ever, they would see each other again. Some were desperate to go. Others were waiting until the 11th hour to make the decision, hoping that something would give on either side or something would change to allow them to stay. They prayed that this dramatic departure would never be necessary. And some made it with minutes to spare, including one British woman who just about made it down from the mountains in time and onto the boat. Reminds me of the advice God's angels gave to Lot and to his family as they impressed upon them the urgency about leaving Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 19 and 17, it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad that he said, escape for thy life. Look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. As a spiritual application, we should in this life be acting as those heroes of the faith did, recognizing that this world is not our home. Many of these people will have lost everything forever. We seek a better, more permanent city, an eternal resting place for the soul, and we should be living in the light of that. Hebrews chapter 11. Soon we'll leave this world of sorrow for the homeland of the soul. Are we living as though we're leaving? And there are people, if I were in a gospel audience, I would be making this application. And in closing, I will make it. There are people who need to be making good their escape by coming to God in and by the only route possible. There was apparently one corridor of escape here, right through Lebanon to Cyprus. Other ways were blocked. There is one way to God, one escape route into eternal life, repentance of sin and faith in Christ alone. Oh, escape, the hymn writer said, to yonder mountain, refuge find in Him today. Christ invites you to the fountain, come and wash your sins away. Do not tarry, come to Jesus while you may. They should be pleading in the terms of Psalm 71 and 2, deliver me in thy righteousness, and cause me to escape. Incline thine ear unto me, and save me. They should be reminded, Hebrews 2 and the verse 3, how shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord, and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him, because for them they shall say, peace and safety. But sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. 1 Thessalonians 5 and 3. And so I think of Hebrews 12:25. See that ye refuse not him that speaketh. Listen to the word. For if they escaped not, who refused him that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape, if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven.